This is episode 79 of the Fifth Estate Podcast. Ken Urell, The Betrayal in Blue. All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I am your host. Amy Otto is not going to be here this week, so I'll be handling the duties on my own. We got a great show lined up for you. But before we get started, as always, kind of thing that we talk about here is, hey, you know, if you like the show, if you like what we do, please go out and, you know, leave a review for us. Go out to iTunes, leave a review. Leave a star rating. We appreciate it. We like that. All right. So for a couple of weeks now, I've been kind of telling people to go, and there's a documentary on Netflix called The 7-5. It's a documentary. Takes place, you know, it's about the 75th Precinct in Brooklyn, in the East New York area of Brooklyn, and it's a great documentary. If for anybody who's ever been in New York City in the late, you know, in like the 70s, the 80s, even the early 90s, and comparing it today, it's like night and day in terms of like crime and everything like that. And the story is basically about, you know, a precinct that had cops that were, you know, kind of working with drug dealers, doing, you know, the kinds of things that, you know, you think you'd only see in a movie, except it was real. There's also a book about it as well. With one of the guys that was in the movie, one of the cops that was there, Ken Urell. It's called Betrayal in Blue, the shocking memoir of the scandal that rocked the NYPD. And Ken Urell is here with us to discuss that and talk about it. Ken, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jay.
Appreciate it. Let's go. For people who maybe haven't seen it yet, who haven't read the book, there'll be some people who will probably have to check it out after, which is fine. But why don't you kind of give us like your, you know, just like a 50,000 foot view of, you know, who you are, what, you know, things, you know, where you've been and, you know, what you're doing now.
Well, my name is Ken Urell, as you said. I was hired by the NYPD at the young age of 20, back in the early 80s, 1981. Worked there for quite a few years until I was involved with corruption. It came probably 7 years into being there. And it went on for approximately 5 years. And in 1992, I was arrested in a drug conspiracy. And the federal government picked up on it later after we were arrested, and they upped the charges to racketeering. And it went from there. And from that, it blew up into a big scandal, and we ended up making a documentary many years later. It came out in 2014, and from there I had written my memoir years ago, going back to when I was on the job doing corruption. I started writing these exploits down, and I was like outside my body when I was doing these things. I was like, this is just unbelievable, and I wasn't really writing it down to do a book. It was almost like a self-confession, just getting it off my chest, because I couldn't believe the things that I was doing. And from the documentary, I ended up able to write the book, Betrayal in Blue. And now Hollywood has come calling, and they're going to blow it up into a full Hollywood feature. Sony has bought the rights.
That's great. Have they started? Has there been any? Are they still like in pre-production, all that kind of stuff? Or have they started filming it yet?
Yeah, we... They picked up the rights back in 2015 when we premiered.
Okay.
And since then, I've met with two different screenwriters. The director. They just hired another director, Craig Gillespie. Just recently hired him. He's just coming off I, Tonya. So he's a big-time director. And, you know, Hollywood moves at their own pace. For, you know, for me, it's a very slow dragon thing, but I'm being told that it's moving very quickly for a Hollywood pace.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's great. You know, so let's kind of get in a time machine, go back to the early 80s when you decided to become a cop in New York City, and kind of explain what was your thought process behind that, and also, like, give us some insight into what it was like to be a cop in New York City in the 1980s.
Well, at the time, after I had graduated high school, I got into the electronics field, and I was doing well in that. But as a kid growing up, my father was a construction worker, had drilled into my head over and over to get a city job, because there was a, you know, 20-year pension. There was, you know, unlimited sick days, great benefits, you know, good steady pay. You work in all kinds of weather. You know, him being construction, he was, you know, laid off when it snowed, heavy snow, rain, things like that. There was no pension after 20 years. So if you got sick, you didn't get paid. So he always drilled into my head, you know, take a city job. Regardless, it didn't have to be police officer. It could have been firefighter, you know, sanitation worker, government employee, mailman, something like that. So when the test had come out, in 1975, there were layoffs. So there was a depletion of the police force. By the time the test came out, when I was 18 years old, and I think it was either late 77 or 78. So I took the test. I did very well on it. It was 100 questions. I scored a 98 out of 100. And they started calling me and processing me right away before I was even 20 years old. And as soon as I hit 20, they hired me, and I was on the job. And, you know, 20-year-old kid, here I am, a police officer, and I was born and raised in Queens, so I wasn't far from Brooklyn. I was in the five boroughs. And they ended up sending me originally to Bedford-Stuyvesant for my first 6 months after I got out of the academy. And if you could picture Germany after World War II, that's how Brooklyn was back then.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing now how
Bedford-Stuyvesant, East New York, everything's burnt out buildings, half a building standing up, the other half exposed. You could see the whole interior. It was really bad.
Yeah, I mean, you have hipsters now, like, buying brownstones in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and, you know, and it's like in the
80s. Exactly. You couldn't give those properties away back in the early 80s, and now they're going for over $1 million.
Right, right.
So it's crazy to turn around.
It is. And, you know, so I mean, and just, again, you know, talking about, you know, the burnt out buildings and everything like that, and also the crime rate. I mean, I think this year in New York City, there were under 300 homicides in the entire city.
Right.
You guys had precincts where you had 100 homicides a year back then.
Our precinct, I think it was 2 years running in like 86 and 87, had the highest murder rate in the whole city. I think we had like 148, 150 homicides. It's just in our precinct, little 5 square miles of Brooklyn. Our precinct does not cover all of Brooklyn. And then you have the whole five boroughs that encompass the NYPD. So, I mean, crime rate was out of control back then.
So, okay, so, all right, so you became a cop, and, you know, so obviously you didn't, like, turn to doing this kind of stuff that you did in the film right away. So, I mean, how was it early on? Like, what, you know, for the first few years, what was it like?
The introduction, you got to remember, I'm coming on 20 years old. It's, you know, early 1981. And like I said, the layoffs had happened. So the split of the age from the guys prior to me to when I'm working with guys that were hired back in the 60s, because they didn't reach their 20 years yet. So you got guys that are so tainted and burnt out from working this job, they have no moral compass at all. You're talking about guys when the whole department was, they called it the pad. Everybody took money and they passed it up the ladder. They had the open drawer policy. There was untold amounts of corruption back then, but it wasn't to the extent that we had gotten into, because it was mainly about for prostitution and gambling. Once the 80s came and the drug era hit, the amounts of money that police officers were exposed to was, you know, unheard of. You're walking into a room with, you know, $50,000 in cash and small bills, you know, 10 kilos of coke laying on the table. It was crazy. But like you said, I didn't get into that right away. But the older officers, the senior officers, the veterans, they start you out very slow. It was alcohol. If you're, you know, drinking alcohol on the job, they tend to trust you more because you already crossed that little line. So it was little baby steps. They crossed that line. You went and, you know, went into a restaurant or a bodega. You got a free meal, a free pack of cigarettes. That's how it was. And even if you wanted to pay back then, when you first walk into a restaurant or a bodega to pick up a soda or a bag of chips, the store owner wouldn't charge you. You would take your money out to give it to him because you're a young rookie cop. You know, that's what you're going to do. You're doing the right thing. And they're saying, oh, no, officer, you don't pay here. You don't pay here. And you almost had to fight them to get them to take the money. And after, you know, four, five, six times, you could, all right, I guess we eat and drink for free. So it's baby steps.
Okay, so then let's fast forward a little bit. I mean, now let me ask. Well, before we get into that, did you like being a cop at that point, or was it something that, hey, it's a steady paycheck, and so I'm going to go ahead and do it? Or did you like the job?
The job was good. I liked the brotherhood, all these guys. It was some things that were, you know, you're working in the. Downright, you know, I can't think of the word, but just torn up neighborhood where nobody cares, nobody does anything. And I'm talking about the neighbors, you know, people that live there themselves. And you got the upper brass is picking on you for minor things. So you almost get like, a bad taste in your mouth. Let's put it like that. A bad taste in your mouth for the upper brass, where they're telling you, okay, oh, your shoe is not spotless today, or you forgot to shave at, you know, 6 a.m. for an 8 o'clock tour because you shaved last night because, you know, you didn't want to wake up early. You're breaking your chops with that, like you were working in Manhattan where, you know, everything was bright and shiny and new. You know, meanwhile, I got to go walk into a building 10 minutes later, and it's mud up to my knees, there's rats and roaches crawling all over the place. It was pointless. So you got a bad taste in your mouth with everything. It was not the best working environment. That's what the word I'm looking for.
Well, yeah, I mean, because, you know, you're going out there, you're putting your life on the line for, you know, you got dangerous criminals, like you said, you're going into buildings with mud and rats and roaches, and then somebody's going to sit there and tell you that you're, you know, like you said, your shoes aren't polished enough or something like that. So
exactly. And, yeah. And it's day in and day out. I mean, they line you up at the beginning of the tour, and they're walking up and down the line looking at your shoes, looking at your, you know, the length of your hair still back then, all types of little nonsense stuff. Like if you were working on, you know, Wall Street in Manhattan, walking a post where, you know, the elite were looking at you, where, you know, you had to be perfect.
Right. So understandably that can make you a little jaded. So then kind of talk about how it, you know, went from, like, you know, like you said, like the bodega owner sitting there saying, yeah, you're not paying for a meal, you're not doing any of this kind of thing. Where, you know, around what time did it start to, like, take a different turn where you were saying, okay, now is, you know, like you're talking about, you make an arrest or something and, you know, there's some money there. You decide not to voucher the entire thing. You pocket half of it or a third. When did it start creeping into something that was a little bit more serious, if, for lack of a better word?
For me, it didn't happen until I met my partner in the movie, which was going seven. I was hired in January 81. I met him in the summer of 87. So it, the things that he exposed me to, it never occurred to me. Like, I would go to these jobs prior to that, and everything would be turned in. You know, nobody that I knew of was taking any money. You know, arrests were done. Everything was done right. And then when I got in the car with him, when we started riding together, he talked about how much money was in the neighborhood and how much drugs were in the neighborhood 99% of the time. Whereas when I was working with other guys, you know, you talk about family life, you talked about sports, you talked about you're going out that night. He just rewired my brain. And when we went to one certain job, we came out from the job, and he handed me cash. And I had no idea. I was like, what is this for? And he goes, it was like prize. Like, you didn't even see me take it, did you? And he shoved it in my hand, and it was a crossroads, you know. Now, obviously, I know it's wrong, but am I going to turn him in for giving me money and not take the money? That's basically cutting my own throat in the department. You can't turn another cop in, because then not one other cop will trust you for anything. Like I said, everyone does those minor things, taking a free meal, taking a free soda, cigarettes, whatever. You wouldn't be able to work with nobody. You would go to work and there would be a dead rat on your car. You would go into the locker room and your locker would be broken into, turned upside down in the shower with the shower running. It would make it an impossible situation. So at that time, I took the money and I shoved it in my pocket thinking, okay, it's not going to happen again, and I shoved it in my locker. And from there, it just grew and grew and grew, and the line grows further and further until a point where you're in that big situation with the big money and the big drugs, and you're so far gone, there is no going back. There's no going back. Once you cross that line, I can't go back now.
And how then? I mean, obviously you sit there and you say, well, part of it is because if I don't do this, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. I remember
it's like the boys' club. You're not one of the boys no more, but there's consequences with not being part of the boys' club no more. Right. It makes a working situation impossible. You go out to your car, your private car in a parking lot at the end of the day, and you have four flat tires. And that's every day. You replace the tires the next day, and you got four flat tires again the next day. And this has happened to people that have turned other cops in for very minor things, never mind taking money or drugs.
Oh, okay. So there's that. But, I mean, in addition, though, I mean, let's face it, when you guys went and you started doing some of these bigger things, it was, you know, having the extra money must have been, you know, I think your wife said in the movie, she's like, you know, having money is good. You know, it's kind of like...
Money always feels good.
Money always feels good. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's true. You know, when I got that first big piece, I think it was $3,500, $4,000, whatever it was that we both had grabbed. And, you know, a normal average person thinks, if I could only get a few thousand dollars, a few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars, pay off a few bills, everything will be wonderful. Well, once you get to that point and you get away with it, you're like, oh, okay, I could get a few more thousand. Maybe I could put some away for a rainy day. Maybe I could take a vacation. You know, and it just grows and grows and grows, and you get more brazen because it becomes so easy, so second nature, and there's no one there. There's no supervision. You're working in this precinct where the bosses are afraid to go out on patrol. And when they do go out on patrol, they're out there for, you know, 5-10 minutes. They make sure everybody is doing a job, picking up a job over the radio, and then they, you know, shoot back to the station house. So there's virtually no supervision back then.
And so did the... Yeah, in the movie as well, Adam Diaz, the drug dealer that you guys were working for, he says that the corruption, you know, like everybody knew about it. Like, you know, you guys weren't operating, and I know you say there's no supervision, but you guys weren't operating in a situation where everything was in the dark, that the higher ups in the precinct knew what was going on. Is that true?
I think to an extent they knew, but they looked the other way.
Right.
They took. I mean, especially once, you know, at one point, this is 1987, my partner went out and bought a brand new red Corvette convertible, and we argued about it, and I told him, don't ever take it to work, because I don't want nobody to know. And he's like, of course I would never take it to work. And then the next day he took it to work and parked it in a sergeant spot. So, they had to know. You know, I didn't want nobody to know. I felt more comfortable. It was only me and him. The less people that knew, the better. He took comfort in the more people that knew, the better.
It was his attitude that if more people know, then it you know, makes it harder for him to get caught?
I would imagine. I mean, he had been doing it for years already, and he had a whole group of cops prior to me becoming his partner who had done it, gotten away with it. Some guys got scared. They actually quit the police department and moved on to other jobs because a scandal had broken out prior to that, about 2 years prior to our hookup. The 77 precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant, where I first worked, got seven, eight guys were arrested on a corruption scandal for stealing drugs and money. And it was a big big rumor within the department that the 7-5 was going to be the next precinct to go down for the same reason. So these guys that were doing all these things walked away from the department, just walked away. And, you know, my partner rolled the dice and said, there's not going to be another scandal because the bosses don't want to expose that type of stuff. And he was right.
So
it took, you know, eight more years until we were arrested out in, you know, Suffolk County, and the Long Island police busted us in a drug ring that from wiretaps from some kid.
Yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about that. Cause in the film, it makes it seem like, you kind of moved from what you were doing and then going out to doing the drug dealing out on Long Island. But there's a little bit of a gap there. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you had actually retired from the force.
Right.
Is that correct? Tell us about
that. I had retired from the force, and there was probably a good year period where I didn't see my partner. He had moved on to another precinct, and I had retired. And I had two other police officers from a different precinct, not from the 7-5, approached me because they had known what I did in the past, and they knew Dowd had become a drug dealer. He was now selling drugs on Long Island while he was a police officer. And they had come to me, and one of the police officers that had come to me was a drug dealer before he became a cop. So they wanted to know if I would make a connection with them to to my partner, and start selling drugs. So to me, it was a very easy thing. These guys came to me, and I'm going to my partner. So the money comes from them to me, to my partner. My partner gives the money to me, the drugs to me, and I give it to these other two guys who want to, you know, start selling drugs. So I was sort of in the middle there, but I'm making money from that because I'm, you know, charging a fee. And that basically got me into the drug dealing. Because the cocaine was so pure, now I'm cutting it and I'm making sales on both ends. And I go to my partner, and my partner is able to buy a larger quantity of cocaine for less money. Because now I'm becoming his partner again, and we're purchasing cocaine together, we're pooling our money, but we're making separate sales. Once we get the cocaine, he's making sales on his end, I'm making sales on my end. So that's what happened with the drug conspiracy.
Okay, this is going to be a good time for a break. So we'll be back with Ken Urell right after a word from our sponsors at Man Crates. Okay, so Man Crates is this really kind of like original gift thing for dudes. I've gotten one of these. It's a knife. It's got my initials on it. It's great. One of the cool things about this is that when you get your Man Crate, it actually comes in a crate, and they give you a little like crowbar that you have to use to get the crate open to get all your gifts. And so it's really terrific. Basically, so if you like, instead of giving your guy out there, ladies, a box of chocolates for Valentine's Day, that's kind of boring. Surprise them with a heart-shaped box of delicious beef jerky, the ultimate snack for aphrodisiac. Mancrates.com. It's the only place to find awesome gifts that guys will love. This isn't some cologne sampler or cheesy mug. Mancrates offers curated gift collections for every type of guy, from the sports fanatic to the home chef to the outdoorsman. Check out classics like the NFL barware crate and the whiskey appreciation crate, or fresh takes on traditional Valentine's gifts like the jerky heart or the salami bouquet. Go to mancrates.com, pick the perfect gift, then wait for that magic moment. He'll fall head over heels when his gift arrives, and he gets to pry the wooden crate open with the included crowbar. They have thousands of five-star reviews, and every gift comes with a complete satisfaction guarantee. All right. So go to mancrates.com/fifth. You get 5% off any one of the gifts that are there. They don't offer a discount anywhere else. It's the only place you're going to get it. So get 5% off right now at mancrates.com/fifth, F-I-F-T-H, mancrates.com/fifth. And we're back. So all right. So now you're doing this. I mean, was this making you more money than when you were still at the precinct? Were you making more? Or were you making less? Or how was that working?
It was close to what I was back when I was in the precinct working. We had hooked up with a major drug organization. We were getting paid $8,000 a week protection money. So I wasn't quite making that because I was selling drugs basically to casual weekend users, but it was coming close because the cocaine was so pure, the customer base kept growing and growing and growing. And it went on, you know, for a year or two before it all fell apart.
So, all right, so now tell us the circumstances around what happened. Now, I was reading Betrayal in Blue. And you from, you know, because you told me you were starting to write down your memoirs, and even in the movie, you know, your wife said you were very meticulous about writing things down. And one of the things that you had instructed the guys who were doing some of the deals was to get the license plate of cars so that you could kind of check them out to make sure that they weren't undercover cops that were engaging. And so kind of explain how that whole kind of unraveled.
I would explain. First of all, when I worked with all these dealers on Long Island, I worked as an ex-police officer. I let them know up front, I'm an ex-police officer. So I told them, I want to know every time you get a new customer, not your old customers. You don't have to keep checking out your old customers. Every time you get a new customer, I want his name, I want his license plate, and I'll run it through the police department computers, which I was doing, and everything was going fine. And we'll know who we're dealing with. Because an undercover police officer is not going to use his own car. It's going to be a car that comes back to either a post office box or it's going to come straight back to Suffolk County Police Department. So this one kid, I go to his house, I make a drug delivery, and he goes, oh, by the way, I got a new customer. Here's his plate. I was like, what do you mean you have a new customer? Did you sell to him already? He goes, yeah, I sold to him already. Here's his plate. I'm like, dude, I have to check him out before you sell to him. And this happened to be the undercover cop. So from his house, they already had his phone tapped. I didn't think it would be tapped that fast because it was, you know, just it jumped out on me. It was a situation just thrown at me. Normally I would go and talk to these cops face to face and then give them the information. They would go back to me. It would be in a stretch of time. But once he said he had sold to him, I just automatically picked up his phone, the dealer's phone, and I called the precinct, the precinct of the cop I was dealing with, and ran the plate of the undercover. Now, meanwhile, they're listening in, and the Suffolk County Police Department sort of freaked out. They're like, who the hell is this? This sounds like a cop. He's calling a precinct in Brooklyn, and he's running our undercover's plate. So I talked to my contact in a precinct. He comes back to me now in person, and he goes, you have problems. It went back to a post office box. I'm like, this isn't right. So I pulled out from this kid, but he continued to sell. I fronted him a bunch of money. He said, here you go. Here's a bunch of money. All you're going to do is deliver an envelope of cash to me all the time. And I gave him all my customers. But at that point, once they had him and they found out who I was, then they latched onto my phone. From my phone, they went, this guy's phone, this guy's phone. And it ended up there was 53 people arrested. I think it was 53 civilians and seven cops that ended up getting arrested.
Wow.
From a drug conspiracy. And then once we were from that point, we're in the papers every single day. Because it's such a huge scandal, and the federal government picks up on it, and now they're looking at it, and they're looking at the careers of the seven cops that were arrested to see what complaints they've had. Did they ever have drug complaints? Did they ever have, you know, anything like that? And they, you know, upgraded the charges to racketeering. They took over the case from Suffolk County.
Wow. So explain now, kind of talk about this, and somebody, you know, and people, again, if you see the movie, there is, it comes to this point where Michael Dowd wants to kind of conduct some kind of thing that will help get a bunch of money and you guys can get out of the country to avoid all this, and kind of explain what that was, what the whole thing was, and what it was that made you say, okay, that's enough. I can't do this anymore.
Well, once I was arrested, I was like, I was already, okay, that's enough. I'm not doing nothing anymore. It's over. We're inside in the Suffolk County lockup, and he's in a frenzy coming up with all these different ideas. We got to do this. We got to do this. We got to do this. And myself and the other cops are in there. Like, this dude's lost his mind. We're not doing none of this. And we finally made bail. It took almost like a month and a half to make bail because they gave us such a high bail, cash bail. And on the outside, my lawyer tells me, which is much what all the lawyers told all their clients, stay away from my partner Dowd because he's the one they're targeting. And it's, you know, obvious by the papers every day. They're talking about Dowd with this, Dowd with that, Dowd with this. So he comes to me every day. He's calling my phone. He's coming into my house. I'm like, dude, let's just make the best possible deal we can. You know, plea out. My lawyer was talking. We were facing 25 to life. My lawyer was talking to the, and this is before the federal government took over. My lawyer was talking to the Suffolk County DA, and he came to me. He goes, probably you'll get 8 years, maybe 10. You know, you take a plea, you don't take them to trial, you don't make them go through a big thing, and that's what you'll probably end up doing. And then you get out in whatever, 7 years maybe. So I was good with that. I was 32 at the time. I figured maybe I'll be out by 40. He came to me, my partner, we both had a lot of cash. He was investing in a lot of real estate. He had three or four houses at the time. And in one of his houses, he had three Colombians renting out his house. So the Colombians had come to him, and they were involved in another whole scheme where one of the Colombians' partners, it was a fourth guy, walked off with 10 kilos of cocaine, and his suppliers were holding him responsible for the 10 kilos. So they went to my partner, and he wanted to go after the guy's wife to pay off the drug debt. So my partner comes to me and goes, look, I got this plan. You come with me. You sit down. We meet these guys, and we'll, you know, be able to skip the country and go to Central America. I'm like, you're out of your mind. We're not doing this. Let's do this. And he would say, no, we have to do this. And that went back and forth for probably maybe 2-3 weeks. Now the federal government goes to my lawyer. They want me to come in, sit down with the Southern District Attorney in Manhattan. So I actually go to my partner. I tell him about it. I go, but now the feds are looking at us. He goes, well, what do they want? I was like, I don't know, but I'll let you know when we come back from the meeting. We went into the meeting, and they started asking questions. I was there maybe 10, 15 minutes, and we got up and walked out. The questions they threw at me, only 4 or 5 people should have known. Myself, the drug dealer in the movie, the guy who owned the stereo shop, and my partner, and myself. So once they knew those things that only us 4 people should know, I know someone else is already talking. So we get up, we walk away. I go back. My partner's waiting at my house, waiting at my door. And I tell him exactly what happened at the meeting. And he banged his hand on my kitchen table. He goes, that's all the more reason we need to do this thing. Because now his thinking is, we're really going to get screwed because it's even worse. We have to get out of the country. Again, much like at the beginning when I didn't want no one to know, he was more comfortable with more people we knew. We were at opposite ends of the spectrum. I just wanted to end it, do what we had to do, do our 8 years or whatever it was, and end this whole situation. And we went back and forth with that for 2 weeks. I went in for a second meeting with the Southern District. I didn't tell my partner this time. And we sat down with the district attorney there. And I told them what they gave me. It's called Queen for a Day. You confess to all your crimes, everything you ever did. And at the end of your case, the district attorney will go in front of the judge and write a, it's called a K-1 letter, and it will explain the extent of your cooperation to the judge, and then the judge will give you a sentence. So, and you can't lie. If they catch you in any lies, the K-1 letter, you don't get the letter. There's no promise of you won't do time. There's no promise of 5 years. There's no immunity, nothing like that. It's just they write a letter to the extent of your cooperation. So I told them everything, and almost as an afterthought, at the end of telling them all my crimes from, you know, day one until the day I was arrested, I go, oh, yeah, by the way, my partner wants to kidnap and murder somebody. And their mouths just dropped open. It was like they were flabbergasted. What do you mean? Explain this to us. And I explained the whole thing like I just told you. He's got Colombians living in his house, renting out his house, and they're going after a guy's wife, a woman, who is being held responsible for the 10 kilos that this guy walked off with. So from that point, they go, okay, now they want me to come back in 4 or 5 days. The DEA is sitting in on the whole thing, and they're going to set me up with a wire. I did not expect that. But now, at this point, I'm so deep into the cooperation after I exposed myself and told them everything, I can't say, oh, no, I can't do that. I'll wear the wire, and hopefully nothing will go beyond that. My partner will come to his senses, and this kidnapping and murder plot will not progress. Of course, I was wrong. He's plus they wire my phone. He's calling me up on the phone. They're getting all types of phone conversations. It was a nightmare on both ends.
And so now, they're going to make you wear this wire, and this is something else you explained in the movie. They're like, you know, this is still like the early 90s. So you didn't
exactly.
Like this tiny little thing yet.
It's not like today where you have a little pinhole recorder. There's no cell phones where you could record with a cell phone and nobody will realize you're doing it. It was, you know, a tape recorder that I had to tape to my leg. So.
But now, let me ask you something. Did the scene described in the movie where, you know, your wife said that you had kind of like this strange smile on your face as you were kind of like getting the tape recorder attached to your.
Right.
To your leg, and you said you felt like a cop again. Did it actually feel that way?
100% true. That's exactly how it happened.
Wow.
My wife, you know, I don't want to say typical woman, but she's very emotional, and she, you know, had a lot of hard times once all this went down, and she was crying and emotional, and myself as well, and. I'm finally smiling on the morning of this thing when she's. Well, it wasn't even the morning because I wore it on multiple occasions. The first time I was wearing it, and she's like, "Why are you smiling?" I was like, "I feel like a cop again," and I did. I was, you know, going back doing the right thing, and you know, in my mind, a lot everybody, you know, in the criminal world thinks I obviously did the wrong thing. I guess the advocates for murder, I should have went ahead and let the murder happen. I don't know.
So now you've built up all this background. Explain what happened on that day when you were supposed to do this kidnap murder.
Well, there were multiple meetings that were recorded. And the night prior to this, we actually, because I didn't know where this woman lived. We actually finally went to the woman's house, drove by the house, and I recited the address out loud so it would be on the recording. And we went home after we actually, you know, scouted out the location. And now it's like 3 a.m. And they tell me, okay, we're doing it in the morning. I'll pick you up at like 10:00 a.m. So at 3 a.m, now I got to call the lawyer. I got to call the DEA. I got to call the U.S. Southern District. And they go, okay, we're going to send you to go meet one of our investigators. Don't be upset because it's somebody you used to work with in the 75 precinct. One of the detectives in the 75 precinct had gone on to work for the U.S. attorneys after his retirement. So I go meet him in a strip mall, 3 a.m, and, you know, I'm embarrassed. I got to see somebody from the old days. He's like, you know, don't worry. You're doing the right thing. We're going to take care of everything. He took the tapes from me. They went back. They were up all night. They, you know, did a transcript on the tape, and they set up on this woman's house. And then we went there the next morning.
And so now you drive up, you're getting ready to go there, and then what happens then?
We go there the next morning, and I had explained to these guys that, you know, my partner has scanners. We listen to all the local precincts. So when you're setting up there, make sure you don't expose yourself on the radio because we're listening to the police calls. So we get close to the neighborhood where the woman's house was, and we finally turn the scanner on, and I'd say within 2 minutes, you hear a police officer come over that there's a call on. It was Avon Street, and Avon Street is maybe two blocks long. It's a very short block in the neighborhood in Queens, and there was a call that there's a suspicious van sitting on Avon Street. So the two of us look at each other like, that's got to be related to us. What a suspicious van. That's exactly what undercover police officers sit in. And as we're looking at each other, you know, like, what's going on? Obviously, I know what's going on, and my partner's a little, uh-oh, what's that? Another officer comes on and tells Central Dispatch, Central, tell that other unit to disregard the suspicious van. The DEA has a surveillance there. So, obviously, at roll call that morning, when they went out, they told the local precinct, okay, there's a surveillance on, you know, DEA's got a surveillance on Avon Street. You guys stay off that block. You know, they don't want no marked patrol cars going up and down the block to spook us off. Well, they should have also told them, don't say nothing over the radio, you know, radio silence. But obviously they didn't. So, you know, my partner obviously knows now DEA has a surveillance. It's obviously related to us. It's only a two-block location, and we're going in to do this thing. And, you know, I got to play along at this point. So I'm like, let's get out of here. And we went all the way back to my house.
And then it was after that that the guys kind of swooped in and in the, you know, in the film, Mike says that he knew that point it was you.
We went back to my house, and he dropped me off and goes, okay, I'll see you later. I go, okay, I'll see you later. And once he left, I now go to my lawyer's house because the DEA had no idea where I was. It's not a radio. It's not an actual wire where they hear us speaking in the car. I had a tape recorder.
Right.
So they had no idea what happened, that we found out that there was a surveillance there and had left. So I was, you know, MIA for an hour. They panicked. They had called my wife. We don't know where your husband is, you know, freaking her out. And once I got home, I went to my lawyer's office. I was probably in my lawyer's office for maybe 30 minutes. My partner showed up at my lawyer's office. And my lawyer wasn't even there. He was in court on another case. And there was a young associate there, and the associate came running into the bag like he pissed his pants. He goes, oh, my God, your partner's here. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And at this point, I've got to still play it out. Like, you know, I don't know what's going on either. I said, well, let him back here. You know, I'll talk with him. And the first thing he said to me, he goes, are you fucking me? I was like, what do you mean, am I fucking you? If I was fucking you, I'd be sitting down with the DEA. I'm here at my lawyer's office. My lawyer's not even here. How can I be fucking you? I want to tell him what's going on so I know what we need to do in this situation if the DEA is watching us. So I basically calmed his nerves with a lot of bullshit, and we gave each other a hug. He left, and when he went back to his house, that's when the DEA picked him up.
All right, so now let's kind of skip ahead. I mean, I guess the letter that the the prosecutors wrote
K-1
for you.
Letter.
Yeah, so
right, the K-1 letter.
So it obviously they did okay for you, right?
They basically saved my life.
Okay.
I went in front of a judge in a federal court. It was Judge Kimball Wood. I don't know if you know who that is from back in the day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So she had her own little problems with a nanny gate scandal. So it's a whole big mess. So I went in front of the judge, and basically I got up to say something. My lawyer would say something, and then the prosecutors are going to say something, the Southern District, the attorneys for the Southern District. And I said my piece. You know, I apologized. You know, I embarrassed the police department and all that. And, you know, thanked my wife, my family, all that stuff. And I thank the prosecutors for, you know, giving me the opportunity to work with them. And then my lawyer said a few words, and then the U.S. attorney, the prosecutors went, and they went on and on how such I was such a good witness. I was unimpeachable. It was the most cooperation, the best cooperation they had in his 7 years experience as a prosecutor, and on and on and on, just praising me. I was like, wow, you know, this sounds good. Yeah, and I'm expecting maybe 3 years, 5 years. And the lawyer goes on. She starts talking about the lawyer. The judge goes on. Judge Kimball goes on talking about a whole bunch of stuff. And at the end, the basic thing, what she said, which I understood why I ended up just getting probation and time served, was she's given me that sentence solely so other police officers will feel comfortable in coming forward and exposing corruption. Because she felt if she gave me any sentence at all, any jail time at all, an officer would never cooperate and would never come forward because it would be no point for him to do that. So that's what I basically lucked out. You know, I did everything right at that point.
And so now you're not going to serve jail time. And so just kind of fast forward, like, you know, because now you live, I guess it's okay to say where you live. Is that right?
Yeah, it's out there. I'm in Florida.
Okay, so you're in Florida.
They didn't want me to stay in New York. They politely asked me to move on. So we had some property down here. I came down here. I rented for 2 years because I didn't know, because I didn't get sentenced. The sentencing didn't come till 3 years until after I moved, because they made me move the day my partner was arrested, the day that whole kidnapping scheme went down. So I moved in August of 92. I wasn't sentenced until 1996.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't know if I was going to jail for 3 years.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So after everything was settled and the dust settled, I found out I wasn't going to jail. I went on with my life. I got a job. I worked in the automotive industry. We raised two children who are professionals and grown now. I have grandkids, and my wife and I are still together. You know.
I mean, despite all of that, it seems like you have, you know, I mean, and your wife stuck with you and everything, and you know, you've raised some good kids. So I mean, everything wound up good, I guess, as much as you can say that.
Yeah, I was given a second chance, and I made the most of it. I you know. Try to live the way I should have lived the first time around.
Right. So do you have, like, any regrets? I mean, it's a kind of typical question. If you had to go and do it all over again, would you have done it differently?
You know, there was a lot of fun times, but, God, I would know. I would never, ever do that again. Knowing the things I know now, I wouldn't have went to internal affairs when this all went down. I wouldn't have taking the money. I wouldn't have went the same path, but I wouldn't have done the internal affair things where I rat my partner out and you know, expose my career and ruin my career. I would have probably went to a defense lawyer and let him know what was going on, any money that was coming in, put into escrow or something, or maybe go to the DEA right away at the time once it got blown up into a bigger drug organization. There were other routes which I didn't see as a young officer.
And so so you're talking about outside agencies as opposed to like internal affairs.
Absolutely. Because even within internal affairs, they're going to expose me at some point and I'm going to be screwed. My career was over. My only career path after that would be go work for internal affairs.
Right. Okay. All right. So that, you know, Ken, thank you so much for joining us. And I just wanted to say to everybody, you know, the movie is good, but you really, really should buy the book. And when I put the post up, I'll put a link in there and I'll tweet out the link, Betrayal in Blue, the shocking memoir, the scandal that rocked the NYPD. The reason why the book is so great is Ken alluded before to kind of like the stuff that you were writing down. A lot of that is in the book. And there's
details, way more stories than are in the documentary. So
yeah, and there's background on you and everything, and your family and your wife's family, which is really interesting. You know, to kind of get an understanding of what your life was like, and you know, where you grew up and all that good stuff. So it's like the movie's great as one, but then if you want to get the details and kind of fill in the gaps and everything, definitely get the book. And Ken, thanks so much for being on the Fifth Estate. I appreciate it. This was
Thanks for having me. I had a great time, man.
Yeah, so it was great.
I'll be happy to come back when the movie comes out.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, when the movie comes out, you know, definitely have to have you back and to kind of get your impressions of who's going to play you and how they did and what you think and all that kind of stuff. So
we're getting a lot of tweets about who should be playing us.
I can imagine.
People like to offer their opinions.
Absolutely. All right. Ken Urell, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it, and take care of yourself, all right?
Thanks, Jay. You too.
All right.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone. That's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. What a great episode. You know, it's like you read this book, and you read the stories, and you think, this is not real life. But it is, you know, and the stuff that you see on film, you know, you think it can't be that crazy, but it is. It's amazing to read these stories, to understand, you know, what these guys did. You know, it's very easy to sit there and pass judgment and sit there and say, you know, these guys are, you know, crooks and criminals and, you know, and everything like that. But, you know, he ultimately did the right thing, and then he did turn his life around, and, you know, so now, you know, he gets to live the twilight, you know, the second half of his life in a way that some people never get to, so that's always good. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. Hey, again, go out there to iTunes. If you like this, you know, tell people to subscribe, leave a review. We appreciate it, and we will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.